Hey there, John Rallison here, pastor at Journey of Life, and today I want to give you a message on the wedding at Cana. The wedding at Cana. It was my sermon last Sunday. I am the pastor at Journey of Life Church in Orlando, Florida. Our website is www.journeyoflife.org, and I'm doing this in my office because it didn't get recorded last Sunday. So, we're going to explore the wedding at Cana. It's very interesting. It is one of the only times that I can recall that Jesus did a miracle that didn't have to do with some sort of compassion for other people. Here, it's just, I mean, I guess you could call it compassion for the wedding running out of wine. As you'll see in a moment, that's what happens. But it's not the same thing as healing people or raising the dead or calming people's fears or something like that. And other people asked him to do miracles just to prove himself, and he refused. And so this is kind of an interesting little thing. This is the story of where Jesus turns water to wine. And first I'm going to read it for you, and then we're going to walk through it. So here it goes. The wedding at Cana. This is from John chapter 2, verses 1 through 12. On the third day, there was a wedding at Cana in Galilee. The mother of Jesus was there. Jesus was also invited to the wedding with his disciples. When the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Now there were 6 stone water jars there for the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars up with water." So they filled them up to the brim. And then he said to them, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of the feast." So they took it. When the master of the feast tasted the water, now become wine, and did not know where it came from, though the servants knew who had drawn the water, the master of the feast called to the bridegroom and said to him, "Everyone serves the good wine first, and when people have drunk freely, then the poor wine. But you have kept the good wine until now." This is the first of his signs Jesus did at Cana in Galilee, and manifested his glory. His disciples believed in him. After this, he went down to Capernaum with his mother and brothers and his disciples, and they stayed there for a few days. So, here we go. The first thing we want to do is just kind of get... I like to pour on information. So one of the things we're going to do right straight away here is just take a brief look at the geography. You can see Cana on that map, subtly marked, right? So this whole area up here, let me see if I can get this working here. Yep, there we go. This whole area up here is, well, not so much over here, a little bit. But that's Galilee. And so it's marked on there. There's Capernaum. I don't know if you listened to last week's sermon, but it was where Jesus was down here. And then John said the next day he decided to go to Galilee. So that's up here. That's a 4 or 5 day walk. It's about 75 miles-ish, something like that. And so Capernaum, as we're going to talk about in a minute, appears to be kind of Jesus' home base. There's Nazareth, where Jesus was born. And then this is the city of Cana. So these are all pretty close together. This is kind of Jesus' hometown area, really. So now we're going to kind of walk through this a little bit. The first thing here, we're going to go verse by verse. So one of the things we learned last week was that John, the Gospel of John, the author John, is composing this gospel as something more than just a historical narrative. He uses words and he plays with time and numbers and things. This is John who begins his gospel. Well, Luke says he set out to write a carefully researched account, and John begins his gospel. "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and the Word was with God in the beginning." And so we already get a flavor for the way John writes. And so when John uses a number, he doesn't necessarily use it to indicate a quantity of something. It might be a symbolic reference. And this is the first thing I would say to you about this. Here it says on the third day. But the thing is, here's the thing. If you want to backtrack into the previous chapter, John uses the phrase next day 3 times already, so that the third day must at least be the fourth day, but we already talked about how one of these was the day he next day he decided to go to Galilee, which is a four-day walk. So something else is going on with this phrase, the third day. And I'm just going to ask you a question, and you can think about this for a moment. What other biblical event happens on the third day? What other biblical event happens on the third day? And many of you, I'm sure, have already realized it's the resurrection of Jesus. And so when John says, even though it's not 3 days after anything, he just says, on the third day, this thing happened. This is an indication, I think, that John is pointing to the resurrection. Because what we're going to get to at the end of this account is that John's going to say this is the first of Jesus' signs, although we don't know how many actual miracles Jesus did before this or whatever. But if it's the first of his signs and it happened on the third day, it's the beginning of Jesus manifesting himself as the promised Messiah who would die and be raised to life after 3 days on the third day. So something big is happening here, and it points to Jesus. On the third day, there was a wedding at Cana in Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus was also invited with his disciples. We already talked about how that is the third day and the next day things. So they're all there. All these people are here. The mother of Jesus, Jesus, his disciples, and that's going to be significant too. Because what we're going to find out, and this is really an important point, is we need to humanize Jesus a little bit. I think most people who are raised in the Christian faith don't have any problem with Jesus' divinity. But sometimes we miss out on the humanity of the whole story. This whole area is where all kind of most of Jesus' disciples and followers are from, at least early on. And they appear to, many of them know each other before they start hanging with Jesus. So here's John 21, verse 2. There's a list of the disciples, Simon, Peter, Thomas, the twin. And then we have this one, Nathanael. Nathanael was the one we talked about last week, who said, can anything good come out of Nazareth? And Philip said, come and see. So Nathanael, where's his hometown? Oh my goodness, look at that. His hometown is in Cana. So who's getting married? Is it one of Nathanael's brothers? There's more to this in a minute, but just take note. Nathanael is actually of Cana in Galilee. That's his hometown, okay? And then Jesus is there with his disciples for a wedding. We read at the end, afterwards he goes to Capernaum. So if we go backward here, we're going to go to John a couple chapters ahead of the text for today with a wedding at Cana. John 4, verse 21, it says Jesus came again to Cana. And this was after the religious leaders heard that he was baptizing more people than John. So the question is this. Capernaum seems to be Jesus' like base of operations, his main place. And the question is this, is Cana kind of Jesus' retreat city? And I think it's kind of an interesting question. Is Cana like a place where Jesus is known, but he can kind of really relax a little bit? Like Morgan Freeman, where is that? He owns a club somewhere. I think it's in Louisiana where he's from or something like that. And it's a place he can just go hang out. Everybody knows him there. Nobody's like running up to him and wanting him to sign off for like autographs and all that stuff. He just kind of lets his hair down and relax and enjoy himself as a regular person, not just Morgan Freeman. So is that what Cana is for Jesus? It's interesting because Jesus' family seems to be part of that community in a strong way. And I'll show you what I mean. If we just go to the next little set of verses here in the reading that we're going through, John chapter 2, verses 3 to 5 says this. When the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said to him, they have no wine. And Jesus said to her, woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour is not yet come. And his mother says to his servants, do whatever he tells you. And then, okay, so first of all, before we get to Mary, because Mary seems to have some sort of authority here, because she takes charge of them being out of wine, and she tells the servants what to do, and they do it. But let's talk about the wine for a minute, just for interest's sake. They ran out of wine. Why did they run out of wine? Is it because there were more people than expected at the wedding? Was the wedding a little more festive than they anticipated? Or was it poorly planned? We're not sure. But what we know is that Mary takes some responsibility to deal with the fact they're out of wine, and the servants do what she says. So Mary must be like a known person here, right? We don't know exactly in what capacity, but she has some situational authority where people listen to her. Now we get to this little interchange between Mary and Jesus. So Mary comes up to Jesus and says, "Hey Jesus, the wine ran out. The wine, Jesus, they're out of wine." And Jesus is like, "Huh? That's not my problem. Why are you telling me?" But Mary knows that Jesus knows what she really asked him. And so she just turns to the servant and says, "Do whatever he tells you." She turns to the servants and says, "Do whatever he tells you," and then walks away. It's just such a cute little scene. Don't holify this scene. Jesus is just hanging with his disciples, and Mary kind of bustles over and says, "Hey, Jesus, they're out of wine." And Jesus is like, "Why is that my problem?" And Mary's like, "Do whatever he tells you," and then walks back, because she knows that he knows what she just asked her, and he's going to do it, and she knows he's going to do it. So then we get to the next part. John 2:6-10 here. "Now there were 6 stone jars of water there for the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons, because the Jewish people wash before they eat. It's a ceremonial requirement, and obviously it fulfills a hygienic purpose as well. Jesus said to the servants, 'Fill the jars with water.' And they filled them up to the brim. And he said to them, 'Now draw some out and take it to the master of the feast.' So they took it. And when the master of the feast tasted the wine," it was delicious, it was really good wine, "and he didn't know where it came from, even though the servants knew. So he goes to the bridegroom. He's like, 'Dude, everybody always serves like the good wine first. And then whenever it's, you know, had a few, either their taste buds are just dull from the wine or their hearts are a little bit merry, then you bring out the cheaper wine, right?' And then he says, 'But you save the best for last.'" So that's a big deal. Now, we're going to dissect this piece a little bit. First of all, there's 6 vessels there, 6 stone jars. And remember, John uses numbers. Either he notices things or he just puts them in for symbolic value. So were there 5? Were there 7? Were there actually 6? John says there were 6. And so we need to, even if he just noticed the number and thought, "Oh, that's significant," it's still significant. So 6 vessels. Where do we hear the number 6? All you Bible scholars out there, where's the first time we hear the number 6? Yes, it's the 6 days of creation. The 6 days on which the work of creation was done. So can we say, I don't know, can we? I'm not sure. Say the 6 vessels are pointing to the 6 days of creation. If it was just filling them with water and carrying them to the other room, probably not. But what's in the very beginning of Genesis? "The earth was formless and void, and the Spirit was hovering over the face of the water." Oh, I'm starting to get chills. 6 stone vessels filled with water. Sounds like the raw materials of creation. So then Jesus turns the water into wine. Let's talk about that for a moment, because that's got some interesting things about it. So first of all, he doesn't just turn it into grape juice. It's not just a transformation. He turns the water into aged and fermented grape juice. So it's not just matter that obey. Jesus seems to be able to play with time and matter as he wishes. which of course points us back to the beginning of the Gospel of John, where it says that everything was made through the Word, and there wasn't anything made that was not made through him. And so now Jesus is here walking on the earth, the Christ, the second person of the Trinity, however you want to say that. He's here, and now he's not only transforming water into grape juice, but he's transforming water into aged and fermented grape juice. Now imagine those people at the table tasting the wine and trying to figure out where it came from and how long it had been aged, okay? Because we know you age wine and it tastes better, right? And this is really good wine. So those people at the table, they would say, wow, this is really good wine. How long was this aged? And then someone who knew would say, oh, it was made about 5 minutes ago. And they would call BS on that, right? But we have the bird's eye view in this story. And I'm not going to take sides on the young earth, old earth thing, because some people, you know, the scientific apparent age of the universe is like, what, 14.7 billion years? And some people dedicate a lot of time to trying to prove that, well, no, it's actually only like 6,000 or 10,000 years old or whatever like that. And I'm not gonna take sides. I sort of lean toward the 14.7 billion year thing. But if this is a real account of something Jesus did, it does indicate that when you create something, you can create it with an age already in it, because the wine clearly had an age already in it. So does this speak to the young earth, old earth thing? I think what it speaks to is our inability to ever figure it out, because if you're sitting at the table drinking that wine, the only way you would ever believe that wine was 5 minutes old instead of 5 years old is because you believe the one who told you they saw Jesus do the job on the wine, on the water, turning it to wine, right? So it does, I think that has something to bring to our lives about faith and about Jesus and trust. Because I don't, without getting far afield, I think that, I'm just going to leave it like that and let you think about it. All right, so here's Jesus, and he turns water into wine. Let's talk about another change in water that was part of a deliverance. What's the big deliverance in the Old Testament? The thing. Charlton Heston, right? The Ten Commandments, the Exodus. John talks about the Exodus and about Jesus. And here's what he says. The law was given through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. So, the law came through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. Jesus turns water into what? Wine. So let's explore that. This is the first of his signs that Jesus did in Cana of Galilee and manifested his glory. He manifested who he really was, which was the creator entering the creation, right? And John says this is the first of his signs. We already talked about that. So if you count through all the signs in John, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Who'd have thought? The resurrection is the seventh sign. The resurrection is the seventh sign of Jesus, and it points to the new creation. That's what the water into wine points to, is a new creation. It's a different creation. It's a new redemption. It's a different redemption. So here we go. Three things, and we're done. Thing one, the first thing we see in the water into wine is that a very large plan is playing out. That's what all this number stuff going on is. There's a big thing going on. It's the first sign of seven signs in John. So he's trying to point us to creation. Jesus initiates the new creation. The Bible calls him the new Adam, but it's a different kind of creation. It's a recreation. It's a creation from the inside out. It's a creation that takes people's hearts of stone and gives them a heart of flesh. That's a phrase from the Old Testament.
Hey there, Pastor John here. Thanks for listening to the Journey of Life podcast.
What God will do for us.
If you are finding it helpful or uplifting or in some other way of value, so, do us a favor
when we
and
see
your
this
friends
happen,
a favor and share
see
it
all
with
the
them.
Connections.
You could also help us out by
and
liking
and
it
wine,
and rating
and
it on
Exodus
iTunes
and Water into
or
Wine.
Whatever way
we see
you get
that there's
this
a very large
to
plan
whatever
out,
you
and that should
to
give us confidence
again,
as we walk through
for
this life as followers of Jesus. The second thing, so that's thing one. There's a big plan playing out. The second thing is that the plan is for healing and joy. The plan is for healing and joy. Remember what John said. We read it a few slides back. The law came through Moses and the prophets. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. So let's talk about the law and Moses, okay? So the first plague, remember, this was the first of Jesus' signs. The first sign, the first plague in Egypt was turning water into blood. That was a precursor of what was going to happen in Egypt. It was going to be a horrible, difficult, bloody time, those 10 plagues. So what happened to the water points to what's going to happen in the deliverance. Now, Jesus' first miracle is changing water, at least as John numbers them, right? But he changes it what? Into wine, right? Jesus changes water into wine. It reminds me of the old, there's a psalm that says, "You've turned my mourning into dancing." That's Jesus. He takes the water and makes it wine. So just like the water into blood was a precursor of the suffering that was going to happen in Egypt, water in the into wine is a precursor of what's going to happen to the recipients of the miracle immediately there at the wedding, but it's also a precursor of Jesus' whole work of delivering people into joy. John 3:17 says, Jesus is talking to a man named Nicodemus who was a little scared because he was a leader and he didn't want to be seen talking to Jesus. So he came to Jesus at night and was talking to him. And in the middle of that conversation, Jesus gave him John 3:16, which we most of us know by heart, right? For God so loved the world that he gave his only son that whoever believes in him will not perish but have everlasting life. John 3:17 says, for God did not send his son into the world to condemn the world, but that the world may have life through him. That's the water into wine. Water into blood is condemnation. Water into wine is life. Now, there is suffering to come, but the suffering is going to be Jesus, and he's going to take the suffering of the world on his own shoulders. That's thing two. Thing one, there's a big plan going on, playing out. Thing two, the plan is for healing and joy. And thing three, how do we get there? How do we get there? We find out in this story, even though Jesus doesn't do any teaching at all, there's one person who says just the right thing at just the right time, and it's Mary. She says, do whatever he tells you. That's thing three. Do whatever he tells you. Can you imagine what would have happened if the servants would have heard Jesus' instruction and been like, no, what are you doing? The miracle wouldn't have happened if nobody followed Jesus' directions, which really kind of seemed pretty stupid, right? You know, Mary says they're out of wine, and Jesus says it's not my time, and Mary tells the servants, do whatever he says. So now Mary must have some authority because the servants actually do it, right? And, you know, Jesus might have a little bit of a reputation by this time. I don't know, even though it's early on. So they fill water jars with water, and then they draw some out and take it to the master of the feast. Can you imagine being the servant who followed Jesus' instruction to take a cup of water out of one of the jars and take it and give it to the master of the feast to taste? Can you imagine being that servant? That's crazy. But here's the thing. The servants would not have seen what happens when Jesus works if they weren't willing to take his words and put them into practice. They wouldn't have seen what happens when Jesus is at work if they weren't willing to take his words and put them into practice. Jesus said basically the same thing. John 14, verse 15. If you love me, you'll keep my commandments. Why is that? Because that's how we're going to see Jesus work. That's how we're going to see that Jesus knows what he's talking about. Because he's going to say things, he's going to give us instructions that don't necessarily make sense in the moment to our instincts and to our basic nature. What are some of the things Jesus tells us to do? He tells us that if someone strikes you on one cheek, turn the other cheek also. He tells us to give to anyone who asks without expecting repayment. He says if you get in a position of authority, don't lord it over people. In fact, become their servants. This is not how you climb the ladder. This is not how the world works. This is what Jesus says to do. He says, love those who hate you and pray for those who persecute you. That's love those who hate me. Are you sure you know what you're talking about, Jesus? He says that we're supposed to take responsibility for reconciling our relationships, no matter whose fault it is. If you've done something that has broken a relationship with someone else, it makes sense that you should go make it up. But he says if someone else has hurt you, it's still your responsibility to go try and make it up. And that's not normal. I'm sure you know people, and you might have had your own instance where somebody has hurt you and you're going to wait. You're going to wait until they come and apologize to you because they did it and they need to come to you first to apologize, because you're not going to go to them first, because that would be like letting them win or something like that, right? And Jesus says, listen, if you think that way, you're like headed toward a life of bitterness and unhappiness, and you're not going to be walking in the redemptive joy that he came to bring. He tells us to pray without ceasing. He tells us don't judge. So the question is, are you willing to do what he tells you? That's really the whole thing. Are you willing to do what Jesus tells you? Because that's what a disciple is. You learn from the master and then you do what he says, even though sometimes it doesn't seem natural. It's like a coach, okay? Say you're playing soccer. And you're a toe kicker, okay? You kick with the toe of your foot. Well, the truth of toe kicking is it may seem natural, but it's not very accurate. You don't really have good control about where the ball is going to go. The place to kick the ball with power and control is in your instep. It's where the laces are on your shoes, just kind of toward the inside of your foot. That's where you get the power and control. So if your coach notices that you're a toe kicker, and comes and begins to try to coach you and say, listen, if you kick there, you know, that you're not going to get the control that you want. You're not going to become a better soccer player. You need to kick the ball on your instep if you want power and control. And then you say, okay, thank you, coach. And you walk away and you say, well, I'm just going to keep toe kicking. You got no business. You got no business being mad at your coach, because your coach has come into your soccer life. Your coach has shown you what you need to do, and you have ignored your coach's instructions, and you're not becoming a better soccer player, and you have got no business at all blaming your coach because you're not getting any better. Because the plain fact is that you're just not listening. You're not doing what the coach says. And I think that a lot of Christians end up in that way because some of these things about turning the other cheek and taking responsibility for mending relationships, no matter whose fault it is, these kind of things, they're not natural, they're not normal, and frankly, they're not even the advice we get from our friends half the time. And so we're not walking in some of that joy and peace that God would have us, the Creator, come in the person of Jesus, would like us to be able to walk in as we go through this life. So here's the thing. Let me sum it up for you. This is it. Jesus promises things to his followers, but you can't blame Jesus for those things not happening if you don't do what he says, right? Okay, let me sum up the whole sermon for you, and we'll get out of here. In Jesus, the Creator has entered the world, and his purpose is healing and joy, which we can expect if we live as his disciples. That's it. I'm John Rollison. I'm the pastor at Journey of Life Church in Orlando, Florida. Our website is www.journeyoflife.org. Our worship service is every Sunday at 10 a.m. in the cafeteria at Northlake Park Elementary School, 9055 Northlake Parkway. Of course, you can find that on our website. And if you enjoyed this, if it was good for you, let me encourage you to do a couple things. One is to pass it on to other people. If something is good for you, you should pass it on. The world needs people passing good stuff from one to another. And the second thing I would urge you to do is to subscribe to however you're listening to it. If you're listening to it as a podcast, you can subscribe to the Journey of Life podcast. It's on iTunes, Stitcher, it's everywhere. Just go to the Journey of Life website and you'll see it up there. If you're on YouTube, subscribe to our channel and click the little bell icon for notifications so that when new YouTube videos get posted, you get notified of that. So that is the great news that we see as we take apart the wedding at Cana and learn everything we can from it. God bless you with His peace and joy through Jesus Christ. Thanks for watching or listening. Take care. Bye-bye.